Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started.
Hey everyone, wanted to jump in quickly and let you know about the release of the audio version of my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, narrated by David A. Kinesser. If you want to support the show, you can buy it wherever audiobooks are sold. Links are also in the show notes. Now on to my guest for today, Aman Agarwal. The world took notice of Aman when he started publishing blog posts explaining technology to non-techies. People liked the way he easily broke down complex topics into understandable forms. He's an engineer who now teaches tech to executives through his company, Sandpram, to help them better understand what's going on in their own companies and to encourage them to find better ways to manage and scale their business. Aman's explanation of how he breaks down and teaches his content illustrates the effectiveness of his approach, from starting out at a bird's eye overview to building up knowledge using the I plus one approach. Aman's process can be useful for anyone looking to understand or teach a complex system or method. And the process is key for Aman. He comes to see that ultimately, if you don't enjoy the process, then what's the point? Now, let's get better together. Aman Agarwal, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you being on the show. You have a pretty kind of unique thing that you're trying to do. We'll get it all into that a little later. And you're also a judo player, so of course we got to talk about combat sports. But before we do that, as I always like to say, why don't you tell me how you got to do what you're doing today?
So what I'm doing today is I run an executive education company that helps non-technical executives and entrepreneurs be more technically fluent. And the journey started out back when I was in college. This was in 2011, 2012. And I was in engineering school and constantly dissatisfied with how engineering was taught. And this is a global phenomenon everywhere you go. And so right out of school, after a few months doing sales, I joined an education company called Udacity. And I always, that's what got me into technology in the first place, into technical education. And then I realized that I enjoyed teaching and writing. Okay, so I started writing these really long essays on Medium, explaining really complex technical topics like self-driving cars, you know, AlphaGo and all these things in really dumb, simple English so that anyone could understand the details of how they worked.
Okay? Yeah, I like to say Sesame Street simple.
Yeah. And to my surprise, something that I was writing as a hobby got picked up in the news and got read by people all over the world. And I was invited to give talks at many universities, organizations, and whatnot. And people kept telling me that I have a real rare world-class talent for this, much to my surprise, to take complex tech and just explain it to dumb people. Because I always thought of myself as a dumb person. You know, I was like, okay, I got to understand this, how this works, so let me dumb it down. And so one thing led to another. I later became an engineer in Silicon Valley working on self-driving trucks at a company called Starsky Robotics. And then I, you know, did some more sales engineering stuff. And one thing that stood out to me when I was in Silicon Valley is that there's a huge communication gap between techies and non-techies, quote unquote, non-techies, right? It's almost comical sometimes because
yes,
you'll talk to engineers, and they'll say, oh, the salespeople are dumb, right? And you talk to the salespeople and they'll say the engineer is dumb. You can't let them run the sales call. You got to control the sales process and everything. So it's not only a communication gap, it's also a cultural gap.
Huge cultural gap. Oh, we can talk about that not only in sales, but in management of tech companies. The whole mm-hmm. other ball of wax.
Yep, absolutely. And so I realized that why is there such a gap why do most non-technical people don't believe that they can ever be technical, right? And the reason is that I saw that there's a lot of bad advice out in the industry these days. There are 1,000,001 like coding boot camps and mm-hmm. coding classes and online courses and tutorials and whatnot. And there's a huge narrative about, oh, learn to code and you'll be technical.
Right.
And I'll be the first person to say as an engineer myself, learning to code does not make you technically fluent unless you spend 2 years, 3 years doing it with some dedication, right?
Yeah.
You take any software, any computer science kid in college and ask him like, oh, can you build me an MVP of Facebook or Tinder or something like that? And okay, and by the way, I want this to scale to 5 million users within the next 3 months. And find me a computer science graduate, freshly minted, who can solve that for you. So it's not about learning to code.
Yeah, great, agreed. No, I totally understand. I mean, I usually say that to my clients that are mostly technical companies. I say, if you can't explain it to your grandmother, then you don't understand it. You know, they get a little upset because, of course, they're, you know, well, mm-hmm. it's just complicated. And anytime anyone says it's complicated, to me, says they don't understand it. Because the most important thing is to be able to explain anything of any complexity mm-hmm. to anyone. Mm-hmm. That's your job. That's the salespeople, why they're all get nervous about allowing engineers in the room. Because, I mean, what's an engineer going to do, right? Engineer is problem focused. If there's not a problem or a crisis, an engineer is not happy. So what are they going to mm-hmm. say? They are going to tell you everything that could go wrong, every problem, every single wart. It doesn't matter that the rest of the world's great. All they focus on is the negative. And of course, I'm paraphrasing and, you know, of course, there's a broad brush of engineers.
Yeah.
But generally, the population of engineers and scientists' job is to solve problems. If there's no problem, therefore no job. Right? So,
and they solve it with engineering. It's like the only tool.
Yeah.
Have you seen that TED Talk by, I think, Rory Sutherland, the guy from Ogilvy, Britain? He said, so he's a marketing, he's an advertising guy. And he says that not every problem is an engineering problem. You know, so Dakin's, he said that the king of Prussia back then had to get all the people of the country to start eating potatoes, which were like a disgusting crop back then. And he tried to crossbreed them and stuff and all kinds of stuff, and it didn't work. Okay, people were like, this is disgusting. I'm not going to feed my dog, let alone eat it myself. And so he turned to a marketing solution. He said, okay, I'm going to declare potatoes a royal crop, and only members of the nobility are allowed to have it, okay? And all the fields will be guarded and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And soon enough, there was a huge underground industry of people just stealing and making potatoes just because they couldn't have them legally.
Yep. Right. Yep. Yeah. And then, of course, they invented vodka.
Yep.
Another good use for potatoes, apparently. So.
Yep.
Cool.
So, yeah, that's what I'm doing.
All right. So sort of form this education company based on your experience. Lots of, I mean, clearly a huge need. I could go on and on about how Silicon Valley, it does a very poor job of explaining technology to, you know, normal people, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And I can also go on and on about the sales process and how every engineer is wrong, that salespeople are not intelligent or quote unquote stupid. Because if you can build the best thing in the world and if no one buys it, is it really the best thing in the world? Probably not. Just to be honest, like, what are you in the game for? If you just want to build stuff to build stuff, then go ahead, be an artist, right?
Yeah.
Don't tell me it's so complicated that, you know, the dumb sales guy, quote unquote, or sales gal can't understand it. If, again, you can't explain it to someone, you don't understand it. That's on you. That's why I always tell them, explain it to your grandmother. Like, if your grandmother can understand it, then you're on the path to success. And, you know, Richard Feynman, is it Feynman or Feynman?
Yeah,
I always mess his name up.
Yeah, whatever.
You know, the best physicist teacher on the planet, right? You know, his five easy pieces of physics is easy, quantum physics, easy for anyone to understand, right? You just got to spend the time. Of course, it's tough and it's a different issue. You know, like, you got to like expand your mind a little bit, but he explained stuff that anyone could understand. He was also really good at picking locks. So he would pick locks at Los Alamos. And I mean, pretty much a character. And I think the best treatise on how to explain a complex problem and how really, if someone says, put you in charge of figuring out a problem, is he wrote a report about the Challenger.
Oh yeah. The O-ring.
The O-ring.
Yep.
And it's a 15-page amendment or appendix to the main report. And those 15 or 20 pages or whatever it is, one, they're brilliantly written. Like, he just had such a command of the English language and of explaining things. And two, it is the absolute perfect way to explain the hubris of management in a technical organization. And anytime anyone, like, you know, wants to roll out, oh, it's complicated and everything, and or they don't, you can tell they're it's a political thing. I just read that and be like, we're pulling an O-ring. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, man.
Yeah.
Like, there was literally a study about research papers and how even Nature magazine showed clearly that research papers are objectively getting harder to read. You read the original like papers published by Albert Einstein, and you read the language, like the way he wrote.
Yeah.
It's like you're talking to a friend in a research paper.
Yeah.
And it's just gone downhill. Straight into the pothole since then.
Yeah, it's
whatever.
It's gone up and you know, I always say that and people get upset about this and I don't understand why. It's like you have to write for the eighth grade level. No matter what you write, an eighth grader should be able to read it. And people get so bent about this. Oh, well, but what I'm trying to explain is so complicated. There's all these scientific terms. I mean, just on infinitum. And I really, it annoys me because that's just an excuse to not walk through the process. Like you, I like to write. Mm. So my thought process is I always write it down, right? Write it down, explain it, get it out of my head. But more importantly, if you can write at the eighth grade level, a complex topic, you not only understand it, but explaining it makes you understand it even more. So I'm curious, when you do like teach executives about complex technology and writing all this stuff down, does it improve your understanding how you teach it? How does that process work? Because again, more people need to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I was never a DevOps guy. Okay. I'd heard a few terms like Docker, Kubernetes and stuff. And I never knew the intricacies of how they worked. But when I had to teach executives about how these things work, I had to put that in the context of what they had learned before. So I had taught them like how the overall high level system works. And okay, this is how systems scale and whatnot. And so the key challenge for me, the key opportunity for me is to come up with a narrative, come up with a story of how what I'm teaching them now fits in perfectly logically with everything they've learned before in the course. And that is, I would say, it's not an uncommon skill, because I actually picked it up when I studied filmmaking.
Oh.
And you would be surprised if I am a teacher today. If I'm a good teacher today, and I believe objectively that I'm a world-class teacher, mm-hmm. most of the ideas I've borrowed are from two disciplines. One is filmmaking, and the other is how people learn languages, foreign languages, because I'm an enthusiast about that.
Wow.
Filmmakers they've turned it into almost a science.
Yeah.
How do you tell a story that holds the audience in your fist and you can carry them throughout the whole narrative towards the end and guide them to the exact same conclusion that you want to guide them to?
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of filmmaking methodologies, filmmaking protocols that I use while structuring the course.
Hmm. Interesting. So, yeah, I mean, I'm big into story structure, and I would venture to say I'm a story nerd to a certain degree. And I have, a long time ago, me and a bunch of buddies did this 48-hour film festival where you make a film in 48 hours. And,
it
was pretty fun.
What kind of film was it?
it's like a 5-minute film. It's just really silly. But the process, that's actually a really good point. I didn't think of it that way, because the process of making a film, I wouldn't say you have to go to the lowest common denominator, so to speak, but you do have to have a flow, and you have to take the audience to a necessary conclusion. And sometimes an obvious but inevitable or a twist or whatever. But you always want to lead them to the right thing. And
mm-hmm.
I guess, as an educational tool, leading them down the journey, the student down the journey of, okay, this is where you need to be. I want you to end here. I want as many people as possible to come up with that same conclusion or end in the same spot. Huh. And so as part of this process, do you storyboard your content? Well, I mean, how do you mechanically get through that?
Absolutely. So I start with, as a, like, it's perfectly a storyboard. I start with, okay, where is the, so I assume a starting point where the audience has absolutely, I'm saying audience, but the student has absolutely no idea about technology. All right. And then the job is, you have to first feed them information in a way that they can, that is always I plus one. So I plus one is a concept called comprehensible input, which is borrowed from how people naturally learn languages, mm-hmm. How babies learn languages, right? I plus one basically means, if you know 10 words and you look at a text, like a page of text, if it has any more than those 10 words, like within your vocabulary, you can go up to 11 and still make sense of it. But if you get to 12 words where you read 10 words and then 2 words are out of your vocabulary, you won't understand it.
Hmm.
And if you keep it at 11, you will exponentially learn one word on every page. Does that make sense?
Yeah, interesting.
Like one new word is easily digestible and you can put it into context. So it keeps you just enough of a, it keeps you challenged just enough without being overwhelming. And so you, that's when you learn the, that's your sweet spot, when you learn the quickest naturally. And so keeping that in mind, you have to, while teaching, I create a storyboard. Okay, like this is where they are. This is the first lesson, so to speak. They learn this. And then I'm going to give them exercises, push them to I plus one. And then that becomes their I. Mm. And then the next lesson takes them to the new I plus one. Mm. And then the new I plus one and the new I plus one. And it's surprising how with small marginal expansion of their technical vocabulary, of their technical framework in their brain, they learn so quickly that within just 2 months, you can put them in front of a developer doing a system design brainstorm on a whiteboard.
Wow.
And they will kill it.
Wow.
They will speak technically. They can read a blog post written by an engineer for other engineers about how, about some philosophy about NoSQL versus SQL and you know, some esoteric stuff.
Right.
And they can figure out, oh yeah, this is what I, what he's trying to say. This is what the whole gist is. It's pretty surprising.
So how do you determine I then? What's sort of the baseline? Like that baseline must be really important to get first, get right, you know?
Yeah, yep, yep. So the baseline is this one. The first lesson is assumed that, so I assume that the first lesson that I have, which is actually a free lesson, I have it in an essay format on Medium, in fact. That is for to take anyone from zero, complete zero, to the level that I assume at the beginning of the course. And after they read that first lesson, I give them a quiz, which I grade one-on-one, and I sit with them one-on-one in a video call, and I look at every single answer they gave for that quiz and discuss it with them to make sure that they are at I. They are
right.
at I.
Right, right.
And then it's very easy to just, you know, guide them through the film, guide them through the story.
So this I plus one, so does that mean, and I guess just I want to know mechanically how this works. So does that mean like each lesson's one new concept or each part of the lesson or after each quiz so you can kind of gauge, like how does it all come together? So, you know, if you're, you know, you're teaching, let's say you're teaching a non-technical CEO about technology so that they can, you know, get in front of the whiteboard and talk intelligently. And you just said it takes about 2 months to do that. Like how does it break down? I mean, is it one lesson a day? I mean, again, I know this is, gets a little in the weeds, but I'm just so curious on how, how you build these things up because, I do try to educate young entrepreneurs about, you know, being an entrepreneur, and I'm always fascinated on the best way to do that.
Yep, so, absolutely. So, so let me give you the whole, you know, course, like how I how this course is structured and how it works, right? So the first week, so for the first 2 weeks, I make them only design systems at the highest level. Okay, they look at 10 to 12 different software companies, like Facebook or TaskRabbit or Airbnb, Uber, Netflix. They look at very diverse technical products. And we look at the high level. Okay, so how would you design the system? What are the different components? All right, so we're playing really high level here. And after the first lesson, they understand, okay, that you have a back end, you have a front end, you have data coming from here and there, and these are all the things that you need to build for something like Airbnb or Uber or Netflix to work, okay, at the very high level.
Right.
And so simply by looking at 15, 20 case studies, they already have a high-level executive, you know, understanding of, okay, if you give them a new idea, like, hey, I want to build an app to help people find their dogs using a peer-to-peer network in my neighborhood, okay? Something crazy. After you see 20 different technical products, you can tell, okay, in this kind of an application, what are the different moving parts? What goes on in the back end? What goes on in the front end? How do I distribute the different tasks, the different functions, and so forth at a very high level, right? So I get them to a stage where this is second nature to them, where they can talk about how any large-scale system is designed. Then I teach them a little about machine learning. I teach them the basics of machine learning and how, and again, at a high level, different systems that use machine learning in today's world, like the Netflix recommendation engine and so forth. So that is the first module, which is very high level, but they already feel technically fluent at some level, right? The next module is about understanding the full stack. What is the back end? What is the front end? What are programming frameworks? What are programming languages? What is the, like, how do you choose different programming frameworks? And this not involves any coding. Like, there's no programming involved. You don't need programming to understand, how this stuff works.
No, I agree. I totally agree.
I teach them what a database is, the story of what a relational database is and why it makes sense, and when it doesn't make sense. And so that's where I introduce NoSQL databases. And so they understand, okay, the back end, the front end. They look at more case studies.
Right.
They look at, why Apple launched their own programming languages. So they read a lot of articles throughout this journey, which are news articles or some thought leader said something about something happening in industry. And I make them read that and then discuss that topic in detail. Can they make sense of what's going on? Giving them real-world exposure to the kind of stuff that technical people read, right? Mm-hmm. So then I introduce to them, now you understand what the front-end is, what the back-end is, and what the database is. Now we talk about scaling. So I teach them the concepts of scaling, how do you scale a system. And a lot of it is analogous to how you scale any business, even a non-technical business. Like, how do you scale a food business? If you're selling cookies out of your mom's kitchen, how do you scale that to a national operation, right? It's the same. It's kind of the same concept.
No, that's why I'm curious on how you go through it, because the comparisons or the analogies or the similarities to scaling a company, I mean, same problem. It's just different inputs and outputs and a different... You're playing with different quote unquote code. That's why I'm curious on, because I think there's a great metaphor and a great framework, again, system to learn, okay, how am I going to explain my company? If you take the same approach that you have to teach your customers, potential customers and current customers, what you do in this whole I+1 framework, which I think is actually, I've never heard of before. But pretty cool. I mean, I don't, again, that's why I talk to smart people. Like, oh, wow, cool. One more thing I can be smart on, I+1. But I think this is really important. And this is where, again, the technical Silicon Valley fails. They don't understand where people are with I first. Like, okay, if your I, however big it is, and then you need to kind of take them on the journey of what your product does, this whole model of, okay, where are they? Add another concept, confirm, right? Because the most frustrating thing for anyone technical, for anyone that's built anything, is that no one wants to use it. And partly it's because no one understands what it's good for, or it doesn't solve a problem, or this new thing I'm really into is what's the job to be done, and you haven't done the job. And I don't remember who said that. I'll put a link in the show notes, but I mean, I'm really fascinated by this because I think your whole mentality of how do I teach like an executive technology is the same framework, same system, how an entrepreneur can teach customers about their technical product in a way that makes sense, right? Clear, concise, compelling, and oh, I need this. And
I see.
Have them get there faster than just throwing a bunch of ads and crossing your fingers again, the story matters, right? And you actually want to be respectful of someone's time to the point where if it's not for them, eject them. I mean, like, hey, it's not for you. Cool. Move on. Mm-hmm. People waste a lot of time on that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I'm curious, you know, so appreciate you explaining the framework. And again, I like the idea. How has it been with these executives once you've trained them, and how are you using that sort of model to kind of build up this, you know, your business, and, you know, how does that scale? How do you scale?
So the first part of your question, which is like, how does that actually work? How does these executives, how do I make sure that they're always, you know, learning and growing? Is that I think the secret sauce that is not so secret, it's just that I forgot to mention so far, is that since these people are usually experts in business, if you can draw a parallel at every point from something they already know and use that as a concrete analogy for what I'm going to teach them next, that is incredibly powerful.
Interesting, yeah.
So it turns a very unfamiliar concept into something very familiar because it's rooted in very, for them, very common sense principles. Now, if I was teaching eighth graders the same course, they would probably drop out after like two lessons, right? Because they have no business understanding. Maybe someday I'll make a course for eighth graders. But
that would be great.
So far, it's...
Because they would really love that, I think. I mean, I teach middle schoolers entrepreneurship, and they pick it up pretty quick.
Yep.
And I think it just depends on how you approach it. Because, I mean, you know,
yep.
They're digitally native now, right? Like,
yeah.
they know, sometimes they know more than their parents about stuff. So,
maybe. So, yeah, I mean, it's just about... You know, you always have to anchor the student in a comfortable place. And that is the essence of what I plus one means. I plus one means that I is their comfort zone. And to me, since they have a significant business background, that always helps to make it easier to take them to I plus one and I plus one and I plus one. And actually, one of the major exercises that I make them do is to take a business, and especially their own business, and look at all the different moving parts of their business from a non-technical standpoint, and then use the context of technology to see, okay, what can be automated, and which automation or scaling which part brings the most value to their business, all right? And this is, again, non-technical. If you could, maybe it's not politically correct to say that, if you could, you know, hire, like, I was going to use the word slaves, but, you know, robots. Like, if you were, like, in like, 3000 BC and you had, like, a bunch of people to do a task for next to no money.
Right.
And you could hire 100,000 of them. How would that change your business? That's one of the things. Of course, that's not the only thing that technology does, but I use examples like these to set the context, set the foundation for what I'm going to introduce to them next.
It does. I mean, I like that whole, you know, maybe that's not the right word that you use, but I see what you mean, because it's like the extreme. It's like, well, if labor costs went to zero, what would happen?
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
But you still can't scale, mm-hmm. right? Because, I can't hire enough people. How am I going to get a billion people, right? I need a machine, or maybe I need to change the process, or, you know, interesting. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm fascinated by the process. And so we're going to go totally off the rails a little bit. So how does jiu-jitsu play into all this? I mean, you're a jiu-jitsu player, martial artist, like I am. How has that kind of formulated how you teach? Because I do know it's hard to learn judo, like it's hard to learn jiu-jitsu, and the practice and the repetition. And I don't know if the I plus one methodology will work, but how has having the discipline of being a martial artist helped with this?
I think it has definitely. So I think martial arts is one of the foundations of my personal journey that happened to make me a better entrepreneur. And not a teacher. I think that has a very the relation between judo and teaching is so indirect that it pretty much may not exist. But I think being an entrepreneur itself, like it's I dedicate a lot of my current mental status, whatever you call it, mindset, to what I to all the those months and years struggling on the mat and getting my ass kicked. and I think the big thing that I understood after, you know, because judo is, I think, one of the most frustrating martial arts to learn, more so than jiu-jitsu, because I tried jiu-jitsu
really
for a while.
I don't know. I think and jiu-jitsu the thing with judo is frustrating too.
Yeah, the thing with judo is that the thing that makes judo work takes 5 years to learn, even the very basics. You can, after like 3 weeks of learning, you can learn, okay, how do I escape a mount, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You can do something at the most basic level to a novice, okay, like I escape mount. But in judo, when you're standing up and you need to catch them at just the right moment, mm-hmm. so that you're not using your strength, you're just using, you know, physics to throw them, that mind muscle memory, even if you're up against a novice, it takes a lot of, you know, just repetition to train.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Which makes it very frustrating.
Yeah. I've it's funny because sometimes we get some judo, you know, judo players in the mm-hmm. jiu-jitsu, and you know, you can tell, because for those of you that don't know, most jiu-jitsu, when we spar and when we roll, we call roll, we start on our knees. We never start standing up. Very rarely do we start standing up. Whereas judo is all about starting standing up. So anytime I start standing up with someone that actually knows judo, it never ends well for me, even if I'm 50 pounds bigger than they are. That's how powerful it is. So, okay, I'll give you that it's a little more complicated. And so what rank are you in judo?
So I stayed at the white belt, actually, because I kept moving from dojo to dojo. Uh-huh. So I have no idea what belt I am, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. I'll have to go back to a dojo in like maybe next year or so to find out where I am now.
Right.
And even there, they're probably just going to leave me at white belt. Like, yeah, sure. Like, you know, who cares? In a dojo, like nobody cares. You're either black or you're not.
You know? It's true. I mean, it's interesting, you know, because jiu-jitsu has its roots in judo, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a complicated thing, but there was a thing called jiu-jitsu in Japan and judo, and it split, and then it went to Brazil and became Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a whole mess. But you can see a lot of the, like when you were talking about throws and arm bars and stuff, when I was reading your little bio, we use the same terms. It's just, we don't practice literally throwing people. I think it's probably like 10% of the things we work on. The rest of it's how do you escape mount? How do you do an arm bar? How do you do, mm-hmm. you know, a leg lock or whatever? So, okay. So you think that the practice of judo and sort of the martial arts really prepare you more to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah. I think the biggest thing was, you know, I think what forms my philosophy for now everything in life, which started from martial arts, is process over progress over perfection.
Oh, interesting.
Because in the beginning, I was very impatient. I was like, I want to get to yellow and then green and then blue and then black, brown and then black as soon as possible. And then once reality hit, like, okay, it's going to take a long time. Then it was about, why am I not better than last week? Why am I not better than last month? So once I gave up perfection, I fell into the trap of progress. Like, okay, I need progress or something is wrong. It sucks if I'm not improving. Mm. You know, why am I not able to beat this white belt for 3 months in a row? Mm-hmm. And so then that's when I realized that it's what's in your control is only the process. So process means the daily reps, the weekly, the stuff that you need to do. And this is something I learned from A-Rod, from Alex Rodriguez. He talked about the fact. So he's one of the most illustrious baseball batsmen in history, and he said that he has five world records. Mm-hmm. But the thing that he's most proud of in his entire career is that in 20 years he never missed a pregame practice session. Wow. Okay, that's his proudest achievement. And he said that everything else is just a byproduct of just following that process, showing up to that practice session, which is in his complete control. Mm-hmm. And then whatever happens on, because he's also like, I think, number 5 in most strikeouts, something like that.
Yeah, probably behind Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth struck out notoriously a lot, but he also hit a ton of home runs. So.
Yeah. So it's all about the process now. Like, I found, like, now I choose projects on the basis of, okay, am I going to enjoy working on this every day or every week, every month for an indefinite amount of time? Or let's say 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. And if I'm not enjoying the process, if I think the process is like, the progress sounds good, but the process is like not to my taste, then I just don't do it. And that has made me much happier. Hmm. As well as, much more patient, and I can make more long-term decisions. Because once you detach yourself, and I could go into the whole woo-woo, spiritual philosophy stuff about detaching and letting go and all that stuff. Yeah. We could go into that maybe. But it's about, for me, it's just about being hyper-realistic, mm-hmm. which means, and being hyper-cynical. And I think cynical is, the word has a negative connotation, but yeah. I don't like to see it that way. I think it's just about facing reality. And mm-hmm. facing reality, you can only control the process. And if you attach your happiness to the progress, which is not in your complete control, because you can't physically like just command your body into linearly improving, or your skill to linearly improve on a day-to-day basis, you're living much more in line with reality. Hmm. That's how I perceive it.
Hmm. So more okay, because I mean, what's really super interesting, I follow. And occasionally listen to Scott Adams' podcast. He's the Dilbert guy, right? And he's got this wide array of things he's interested in, of course. And he's always about process as opposed to goals. And he's always about building talent. And I really love his talent stack or skill stack idea, because I agree. You only are in charge of the process. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you want the outcome to be beneficial, but you can never guarantee the outcome. Just full stop. Can't. You can have the effort towards that. You can create opportunity to get into maybe having the outcome, but the outcome is never assured. But the process and the effort you put into the potential outcome, 100% in your control. And I really like that philosophy. And I do think it's a bit meta, a bit, woo woo. But I mean, there's a lot of, well, especially Eastern philosophy, I think, Buddhism, I think maybe even Hinduism, I'm not sure. I'm not as familiar with Hinduism as I am Buddhism, where, the path to enlightenment is not an easy process. You don't, when do I get there? You don't know when you get there, but you continue the journey. This whole journey, and like you said, I either enjoy the process or I don't. And if I don't enjoy it, I'm not going to do it. Mm-hmm. I think that's 100% valid thing, because when you are so focused on the progress or the perfection or the progress or the outcome, I like your whole process, progress, perfection, kind of construct, perfection being the goal, the complete in my mind. Mm-hmm. Although I do like that it's, three and it's P's for whatever reason. But as you kind of think about life, and I'm a little older now and sort of thinking about kind of the latter half of my existence, enjoying the journey, really, although it sounds woo-woo and meta and all that sort of stuff, really is about this process. What process are you mm-hmm. using in your life to get better? What process in your business? How can you build a process that you hope is repeatable enough to make the progress so that you reach the goal, or the goal being the perfection or the end game, right? And knowing that you have no control of the outcome, you only have control of your effort and the process in which you do it. That's pretty powerful. It's pretty powerful.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to be the first to say, 5 years ago, I had heard about, you know, I'd heard the quote, like, it's about the journey, not the destination. As much as I had been stuffed with that, you know, saying, I never internalized it. Never, ever, until I started training judo. And then after a while, it started to sink in what it really means. And it really means is that if you don't enjoy what you're doing at all, if it completely sucks, then you need to take a step back and see, where am I really going with this? Is this really, if I were to die tomorrow and this whole thing had met a premature end, and I think this goes back to like the Steve Jobs talk about, oh, like every day I wake up and I look in the mirror and see, is today the how I would like to live the last day of my life? I think that's a little extreme, personally. But the germ of truth, as I like to call it, in that story is that, yeah, you need to be doing stuff that gives you some form of happiness day to day, so that even if you don't reach the goal, the process was not distasteful to you.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I sort of understand Steve Jobs quote a little bit more. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I talk about my late wife a lot. You know, she passed away 3.5 years ago from leukemia. And, you know, at the age of 36, right? So she never thought her last years on the planet would be at 36. Mm-hmm. And that 15-month process with battling cancer and me being her primary caregiver and trying to run the business I now run by myself, I got pretty wrapped up in the negativity and the goal and the perfection and all that sort of stuff. And now, you know, it sounds a little weird, but when I do wake up, I'm like, wow, another day. Okay, good. I got another day. You know, hopefully I spend this day well. And sometimes I don't make it, right? Sometimes I don't spend the day well. I get wrapped up in someone that pisses me off or, you know, this isn't closing, that isn't closing, this you didn't get the deal. Oh, I wish I had this. I wish I had that. And then I got to kind of stop myself. And I stopped myself because, like, everything that from now on, you know, since she passed on has, you know, you got to think of it as a gift. And then how am I going to use that to make the world better? And again, that sounds meta, but that's the journey, right? That's how do you enjoy the process of your life so that every day is a good day, or at least I always like to say I didn't waste today. Yeah. So I really,
that's powerful, man.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your time coming on the podcast. It was really fascinating to understand and hear how you teach people that aren't technical, at least some technical knowledge so that they can, you know, make good decisions. Right. I mean, it's important. It's really important. So thanks for that. Good luck on the judo mat. Maybe one day we'll get together and we'll see if jujitsu and judo, although I'm a little bigger than you, so I have an advantage, but thanks again.
We'll see.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks again for your time and stay safe.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur and, frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.